Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Come one, come all, and get your knife on. Something like that, right? Welcome to another episode of Knife Talk. This is the show where we help you, whether you're a new maker, experienced maker, answer your questions, troubleshoot some of the issues you might be coming across with your knife making work, whether it's the actual knives or customer interactions or whatever, everything in between. We're also here to just keep you company in general while you're grinding away in that commute or in the shop. And as not as always, but I'm often here for most of the time, except for when I'm traveling. I am Mareko Malmasi of Malmasi Fire Arts. I almost said fire farts.
That's a new name for you.
And then I'm here with Craig Lockwood, our local rock and roller of Chop Knives, officially staying as Chop Knives. I'm into that. And unfortunately, this week we don't have Jeff Fader. Jeff Fader is our behind the scenes. He's one of our he's big helper behind the scenes. And I want to take a second just to like give a little bit of an homage to Jeff. He does a lot of work, and I think he's taking some vacation time right now, which is much, much deserved for him. Him and the wife are cruising around, and Jeff does a lot for this podcast. He has his own podcast. He collates all the questions. He does a lot of he runs the Instagram. He's interacting with everybody, and I think, you know, you just never know, you know, when we're going to be gone. And just getting on in age, you know, he's got maybe just a couple more years left in him. And I just think he does so much for all of us here on the show and also in the community. And if we could just troll the shit out of him with kindness, I think he would fucking hate that so much. And it would feel really good for me.
He would.
So I just want, we always kind of talk shit about him, give him a hard time. But I think the thing that makes him the most uncomfortable is kindness. And so let's troll him with kindness this week and just start hitting him up, showing some love. He'll really hate it. So anyways, Craig, what has the last week been like for you? Buddy's, has school started yet?
No. So okay. Monday coming.
Okay.
So, I mean, when you say the last week, I'm just like, it's been a week?
It's what? Amazing. Yeah.
It feels like 2 or 3 days. Yeah. This week has absolutely flown by. As I'm sure most parents will probably say as well, because, yeah, most kids are back in school next week. Yeah, I'm trying to think what I've actually done this week. I mean, everything's out now. All my equipment's out, and I've spent some time grinding. I've been doing stuff. But it does seem like 2 or 3 days ago. It seems mm-hmm. crazy. But, yeah, we'll be glad when the kids get to school on Monday. So Buddy, our smallest, he actually starts as well on Monday. So for the first time in over 5 years, nearly 6 years, we'll have our days back, my wife and I, which is daunting, but exciting too. So roll on Monday.
All right.
We've been up to it in potty training all week, and it's sweet. we can't wait to get rid of him. But potty, no, it's all good. It's all good. We're having a sort of a late summer here as well. It's still roasting hot, so we're quite lucky where we are. We live in this tiny village, but we've got like a village pool, and it's like an Olympic sized pool. It's huge.
It's where, and nobody goes uses to pee. It. Oh, okay.
Well, basically, yeah. but nobody uses it, so we quite often have the whole pool to ourselves. You know, so we've been using that a lot this week to cool down in, and it's all good. We've actually got a film crew here in the village this week as well. We've got this huge chateau in the village, and it's used quite often for, you know, film sets, that kind of thing. But I'm not quite sure what they're filming, but it's huge.
Probably just porn or something.
quite
in the
possibly.
French countryside.
quite possibly. But I mean, there's dozens and dozens of, you know, of crew vans, and they've got catering trucks there for them and stuff. So it's a big old event. So yeah, that's quite big for our village at the moment. But yeah. But yeah, that's it. It's been, I say, it's flown by, and yeah. Summer is, even though it's still warm, it feels like it's coming to an end with those kids going back to school.
Yeah.
It
is nice to get that time back. Even though you get those few hours back, it still feels like there's hardly any time in there, because then you're like, oh, I can do all this stuff now without a bunch of people bothering me. And then all of a sudden it's gone and it's time to go pick up the kids from school.
Yeah, it's 4:15. You're like, well, who's going to get them? And it's like, oh,
right.
Yeah.
I think last week I was talking, it was raining, which I was really psyched about, because that means our mushroom season is going to start popping off pretty soon here. And we've snapped right back to summer weather again. We're back in the high 20s for you Celsius. I think today is supposed to be about 30 Celsius, or at least, sorry, tomorrow is supposed to be 30. The next day is supposed to be like 31, 32 Celsius. So it'll
pretty
be nice.
Much the same as here. Yeah.
Pretty nice and warm. We'll probably have to go find a swimming hole somewhere. But otherwise, just this last week's been sharpening week. I've been also cleaning in the shop. I think I also mentioned last week, and it's been like a year and a half, 2 years of putting it off, procrastinating like a boss. But it feels really good to get things tidied up. And I think what was happening is I just keep putting it off. But I got to a point where it was so overwhelming that it just seemed like such a massive task that I just was overwhelmed by it.
Yeah.
And then I would just keep coming into the shop, and the shop was always a mess, and it was just this air of this cloud. What is it? I think it was like either like Winnie the Pooh or Snoopy, or somebody would walk around and a cloud would be floating. Maybe Eeyore, actually.
Yeah,
the cloud,
it's Eeyore, yes.
Walking
yeah.
around the cloud over him the whole time. That's what it felt like. That's what it feels like being in the shop. But it's felt a lot better now. And I feel like I can really get back to work without having to like dodge everything. And it was almost to the point where it's like you see these terrible episodes of Hoarders. I don't know if you guys have that over in the UK.
I know what you mean, though.
Walking through like these narrow passageways between these piles of shit, and it wasn't that bad, but it was just a mess. It was overwhelming. It's a lot, and it feels better now, so I'm excited to get back to work. Let's see what's going on. Oh, we just had the business meet. Me and my wife helps with the business. And so we had business meeting stuff today and dialed in. Maker Camp is coming up in just like a month. It's going to be this time next month. Just over a month. In early October. I think it's October 11th to 14th. If people don't already have their tickets, go to Maker, or what is it? I think it's the Catskill Mountain Maker Camp, or Maker Camp on Instagram. And you can get information about where to stay and how much it costs to go. And it's just such an incredible event. Honestly, like we've been taking my kid every time we go, and he absolutely loves it, because you get a chance to like dabble in all these different disciplines and creative outlets, block printing to welding to sewing, leatherwork, forging, I don't think they let people do the wood carving, but they have robotics there and CNC routing and powder coating. And they just, the Total Boat's there doing their Total Boat thing. They do a regatta every year where everybody builds these boats and then they race them across this pond, which is always just a shit show and also super funny to watch. Yeah. And so it's been super cool. But I got my classes dialed in. It's going to be all based around kind of like mathematics and material management for me this year. And so I the first day, so I teach six classes. They're only 1 hour each, so it's not too intensive. But so it's a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So on Friday, I'll be teaching pattern welding. I'll be doing my pattern welded walkthrough on a pattern called Huxley's Doors. And this is a pattern that I use mathematics to kind of like figure out and reassemble the billet in. And I'll be teaching that once in the morning, once in the evening. And then I have the next one would be blade math and forging progression. So it's how I use mathematics to figure out the volume of material I need to for a particular blade, and then how I transpose that into physical material, and then I'll go through my forging progression. And then on the third day, on Sunday, I'll be doing what is it here? I got it right here. Pat or tile welding and pattern expansion. So the one of the most difficult parts, especially if you're getting into mosaics, is understanding how much a pattern, so you make like a mosaic pattern, whatever it is, and trying to figure out how big of a kind of a quote-unquote tile, like you cut it off, a little biscuit off the end, and how much to cut off because you want it to expand a certain amount. And there are a few different ways to approach tile welding, so I'll be going through all that on that at that class. And then right after Maker Camp, I'm going to be hanging out with Josh Prince. I'm going to be doing some work with him for a day and a half. And then teaching my Decoding Mosaic Damascus class over in Providence area of Rhode Island. So if people are interested in more information on that, I'll be up in the Northeast teaching that two-day class in Rhode Island. It's either going to be a Tuesday, Wednesday, or Wednesday, Thursday, which is kind of awkward, but that's what we got to work with. So hopefully there are some makers out there that can make the time and make the trip. And I'm trying to just like, if people want to travel for it, they can travel for it. But ideally, I'll probably just be pulling from like the local population with like within an hour or a couple hours of driving distance, so people can go home at night and all that kind of stuff. But it's going to be a great class. I've been teaching that. This will be like the fifth time that I've taught this class. And it's amazing watching people walk away with like a completely different understanding of how material moves and how to look at mosaic Damascus patterns or Damascus patterns in general, and being able to reverse engineer them. I call it, it's like a Damascus enlightenment, essentially. or if you've ever seen The Matrix, like at the end of the first movie, he gets shot and then he comes back alive, and then he can see the code of the Matrix in everything. And so that's how I look at Mosaic Damascus. I can see right through it. I can see the code in all the different individual steps that it took to make the pattern, as well as like the original starting stack. I can see all that information's there. You just have to understand how to look at it. And that's what that class teaches you, which is why it's called Decoding Mosaic Damascus. So I'll be teaching that. If people want more information, hit me up. Shoot me an email. MalmasiFireArts@gmail.com is the best way to get a hold of me. And there will be limited room in that class. So hit me up sooner than later. But otherwise, just kind of like, it's going to be like my last push before the end of the year is teaching, going up to Maker Camp and then teaching that class.
So people camp there for a few days. It's like
Maker Camp. So Maker Camp, it's just giant. It's probably, gosh, I want to say it's like 30 acres or so, maybe 50 acres. It's a giant property. And so it's interesting because they have like a RV park where they're seasonal people that come up and they live there just for like the working season around the area doing whatever. Either there's like a lot of farms up there, or there are some year-round people, and then there's spaces for, you know, just random events. They have motorcycle rallies and dog rallies, or whatever you want to call them, doggy get-togethers. Before they close the pool down at the end of the summer, they do one last hurrah where all the dogs get to come together and go swimming in the pool. So at Maker Camp, the pool is still there, or the pool doesn't go anywhere because it's an in-ground, but the water is still in the pool, but you do not want to go swimming in that water.
Just full of dog shit and hair.
So disgusting. But Yeah, it's super fun. It's cool. And they have also a bunch of facilities there where people can, like little cabins and little hotel room kind of things. Tons of all these little spots that where people can stay. It's really cool. It's a lot of fun. And it's a great opportunity to connect with people again in real life. You know, we make all these connections online or we follow these people online. But the benefit of these events like this, or Blade Show, or Maker Camp, and so on, or Hammer-Ins even, is like you get this opportunity to meet these people in real life and make real friendships and develop those relationships in a real way that strengthen that bond so that you can either become friends or mentors, or you can... Honestly, like, I feel a lot more comfortable just cold messaging somebody, or calling them or emailing them if I've already met them in real life. And so we have that kind of base of rapport to kind of expand on, and versus like people cold message me and ask me a bunch of questions. Like, I don't know who you are. I don't know where you're at. I don't and it really becomes a question of, do I have the time, or do I feel like I'm going to take the time to go through all this stuff with somebody like that I just don't know? Are they part of my Patreon?
Yes, total stranger.
So it helps in that end of stuff. But
We got a lot going on. October 11th.
Is the first. So yeah, that's a Friday. So it's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So the 13th is technically the last day. Monday, the 14th, is still part of Maker Camp, quote unquote, but that's really kind of the loadout day. And but there's still a bunch of people hanging out and cruising around. But yeah, it's going to be a fun event to do the Maker Camp and then follow that with a class, making that trip work double duty so that, just to get as much done while I'm traveling, might as well.
Yeah.
Rather than making multiple trips, you just do it all in one.
Makes sense. Yeah. Makes sense. You know what else makes sense?
Let's hear it.
Knife Talk is sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com.
Do it now. Okay, well, Jeff isn't here, but thankfully he's done some questions for us. He's listed all the questions like a good little puppet. So Randy Reichart has sent a question in, and we are Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. So if you've got a question for us, please DM us on Instagram. And Randy's done exactly that. And he says, what is the most common mistake you see knife-making newbies doing? The one I see almost every time is the pin holes blown out on wooden knife scales, leaving those ugly splinter tear outs showing. Like, come on, guys, use something to back the underside of the wood when you drill the pin holes. Common mistakes. What do you see, particularly with sort of beginners, Morocco?
Sure. I feel like I see makers either, especially new ones, overextending themselves by trying to like use all the flashy, fancy, cool, trendy, fad kind of materials, or trying to be too original too early. Because I see some knives out there that are really, really rough and kind of awkward looking. And I think, honestly, it really benefits a new maker, to find work that they really like and fucking just straight up copy it. To learn the form, especially about the learning the forms, whether it's chef's knives, hunting knives, whatever, learning the form, understanding kind of the nuances that you don't really experience just by looking at pictures. Because as you start to sculpt and remove material, you get more of a physical feel of the thing and the balance for the thing. And that really informs you on, this is why this is this way, this is why that's that way, and being able to make better decisions as you gradually work towards developing your own style. Maybe some people have a lot of experience with a certain kind of knife. For me, it was culinary knives, but if somebody's like an outdoor person, like you, Craig, getting out into the woods and bushcrafting, like you have a lot of experience with knives, and so you had a pretty well-informed you're coming at the design from a very well-informed position, which I think is great. And I think if you're trying to do something that you're really kind of stepping outside of the box for you yourself, especially as I see it the most in culinary knives, try just copy a knife. copy a few knives, actually. Do it for a little while until you really start to get an understanding of why things are designed the way they are, and the relationships between the blade and the handle, even the edge profile to the spine profile, all that kind of stuff. It's really important, because otherwise it just looks really awkward. It doesn't look pleasing to the eye, and it makes it difficult if you eventually want to start selling things if they don't look right or feel right. And the only way you can kind of start to do that, I think, is by copying things that already exist and are already doing well, and then eventually develop your own style around using that those previous iterations or those previous works as kind of a scaffolding or a jumping off point.
Good point. Common mistakes. I think I was extremely guilty of this myself.
Okay.
And I'd say newbies making a knife, making a second knife, making a third, making a fourth, and then, how do I make this my job?
Oh, God. Okay.
And we have this question every week. Somebody will DM us, like, well, you know, when is it time to jump 2 feet in? Am I ready? And all that kind of thing. And
sure.
We can never give the answer, because everybody's circumstance is different.
Right.
But I think for a lot of people, they'll enjoy making knives to start with. They really enjoy it. They realize there's this whole community out there, and they sort of get involved in the community. Then they realize, well, lots of people do this as a living. It's their job. They're like, well, I want to be doing that. And they jump in before they consider all the difficulties that, sure, that could entail. And we see that so much. So I think hold on to that sort of joy for as long as you can of there being no pressure. We've all experienced, crazy pressure, particularly taking pre-orders and all that kind of thing. It can really build up. So I think, it's a real common mistake we see people starting, then all of a sudden, right, this needs to be my job now. And I think, well, just maybe hold tight just a little bit.
Yeah.
And underside of handles, I say all the time. You see people that take photos of the knives, and they'll never show photos of the underside of the handle, particularly with full tang knives, because they could be obviously the most difficult to finish, not being able to use a machine for that. So spend some time doing those undersides of those handles too.
Undersides of the handle? What do you mean on the like where the scale rests against the tang, or
where you've got the spine where your handle is, the underside, the grip side.
Okay.
Quite often that they can look pretty rough, or people intentionally won't share pictures of that area.
sure.
Because it takes a fair bit of time to tidy up,
It does, yeah.
Maybe pay attention to the underside.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. It's tricky.
Okay,
business.
Do you want to take the next?
Yeah, I'll take the next one. Is Big Ham Forge. What does that mean? Or is it maybe it's Bigham?
let's say Big Ham. Again.
Big Ham. Big Ham. Mr. Big Ham Hands is asking. Hey guys, first off, amazing podcast. I have listened to every episode and love the way it has evolved. I have a quick question. With stabilized handle materials, do you put a coating on it after finishing to give it a greater shine, or just leave it as a buffed gloss finish? What is the best way to get it to really look like glass? Cheers, gents. P.S. Jeff, your banter and humor is what keeps me coming back each week. Craig, I'm expecting a TV out of the hotel room story coming from your rock and roll adventures. And finally, Marco, your knives have inspired me to look at my Damascus and push to one day be half as good as yours. Well, thank you. Okay.
Big Ham.
Big Ham Hands.
Finishing stabilized wood. If it's stabilized, it's being impregnated with the resin. Quite often that resin will buff up really nicely itself, depending what resins they've used and what the wood is, really. And the colour as well, I think. But to get it really looking like glass, I use buffing wheels. I also use furniture wax as well. Mm-hmm. To really give it that sort of gloss.
Sure.
Marekka, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, it's only actually been in the last maybe 5 years or so that I've been trying to do other things to really make the handle shine. But you can actually get a pretty nice shine on most handle materials. Now, it's not true for everything, but just because they are stabilized, and it's just taking the time to take it to a high finish and having a good buffing regime, basically. And honestly, my buffing regime was never too crazy. I would finish the sculpting off the machine on a 400 grit belt, but not like a fresh one. It was kind of like a worn out belt. So it really kind of burnished the surface and kind of started the polishing process, honestly, at that point. And then I would take it to the buff and I would hit it with the scratchless rouge, which is usually like a pink rouge or something like that. And I would hit it and it would shine like crazy. That does kind of dull over time in use and handling, really, because it, part of that finish is the wax, but sometimes the wax can wear down. But I see people getting really great results with like True Oil, which is like an oil that's actually used often on firearms as like as a wood finish for the grips or the gun stock. And honestly, like some of those gun stocks are pretty insane how high of a finish they get and how durable those finishes are, because they are going out into the field and being used and getting wet and dry and wet and dry and exposed to sun and all this kind of stuff. And it is something that is somewhat reasonable to try to maintain over the life of the knife. I think one of the things that's really difficult in some of these handle finishes, like people do like super glue finishes, but the problem with the super glue finish is how much of a pain in the ass it is to do in the first place, because you have to put on layers and then sand it back and put on layers and sand it back. And if you have any facets or any sharp corners, like you have to be really careful not to accidentally keep cutting all the way through the super glue every time you sand it back. And say you get it dialed in and nail it, then at some point it'll probably, if like depending on the surface that your customer, if especially if it's a chef's knife, say somebody has a slate countertop of some sort or a stone countertop, the handle could potentially be rubbing against that stone and eventually getting through that glue. And then what do? They can't really take care of that themselves. I mean, they could try, but it's probably going to end up messing up the handle. So then are they going to send it back to you? Are they going to figure something out or just live with it? And then your work's out there with this kind of like busted up finish on it. So I think I've been trying to figure out a way to make my finishes as sustainable as possible and also easy for my customers to maintain themselves. And so honestly, I've just kind of been taking it back to really basic stuff and just taking it to a really nice hand sand finish and then finishing it with wax. And it doesn't have like the super sheen gloss that a lot of stuff has, but it's more true to what it will look like over its entire lifetime and use with that person.
So you're not buffing the wax?
So the wax that I have has like has carnauba mixed into it, so it takes a really nice high hand buff, actually, just with paper towels, because that carnauba wax hardens as you continue to buff it in, and it's pretty wild how high of a shine it takes. But that also doesn't stay super shiny, but it is something that if a customer is like really wants it to be shiny, they can source that same wax. They can also use that to bring it back up to a nice high luster sheen, whatever you want to call it, gloss, so it looks really pretty, versus something that's more of an intensive process of trying to finish and then also potentially trying to maintain. So I try to think of not just what it's going to look like when it's done, but the thing as a tool that's being used in its entire lifetime, which if I honestly, to be fair, was not taking that in consideration when I was doing some of my processes. But now that is definitely something I try to take in consideration, because I want my customers to potentially, if they decide they want to, be able to maintain the knife as much as they can. They do that with all kinds of stuff. They should be able to do that and have that relationship with their knife as well.
So I think as much sort of wax and buffing that you do, it goes back to that hand sanding first.
Yeah.
Take that up to the highest grit you possibly can. Because, you know, finishing on a 600 grit, then chucking some wax on, it may look good temporarily, but as soon as that wax starts to wear, you get to see that sort of rough finish underneath. We're using Dasa Rhino Wet, and why wouldn't you? Yeah. It's going to save you time, and if it's saving you time, it's saving you money. Take that right up to the highest grit you possibly can before you start buffing and waxing. And you can get your Indasa Rhino Wet from TexasFireSupply.com, where they sell everything for the knife maker, whether you're a farrier, bladesmith, knife maker. If you're moving metal, head on over to TexasFireSupply.com. As I say, they sell Indasa Rhino Wet. They sell everything else you could possibly need. Fill up your basket and use Knife Talk 10 at checkout and get 10% off the entire order. So make sure you do that.
I was just noticing Big Ham also said that they are from Victoria, Australia.
Ah, cool.
I didn't notice that earlier.
Yeah, nice. Do they still go, the Australian Knife Talk guys?
I think they've taken a break for now. I think every once in a while.
I don't think they were as hardcore as us. They pretended to be. They went too hard and they didn't last out. We're in our seventh year and where did they end?
I think
washed up there.
To be fair, I think there have been some life changes and challenges for some of the guys. I think I just saw Corn actually on Instagram. He's like in the hospital with like fucking cast around his neck or some shit.
Oh, fuck. Okay. Now make me feel guilty. Sorry.
I'm just saying.
I didn't know. Sorry.
Life happens.
I'm sorry about that. Jesus Christ.
No, I'm sure.
Right. Moving on. Maverick Knife Works. Hey, KTP question on forging an integral bolster chef knife. For starting stock, which is easier, a round hex bar or a flat bar and forge welding pieces on the side? That's from Maverick Knife Works.
Mm-hmm.
That one's for you, Mareko. All you.
Yeah, okay. So starting from large Damascus stock or weld, honestly, I think it depends on what you have available to you. I would, if you if you're limited on tooling, okay, let's say we're just going to do a mono steel, but we want to do integral. We don't have a forge. We don't have all the fancy forging equipment and stuff, but we want to make an integral. You could, if you have a TIG welder, or honestly, like the good old fashioned way would be to silver solder guards on essentially onto the blade. You could forge weld out of your heat treating kiln for sure. You just got to make sure you're dialing in the right temperature and giving it the right amount of soak time. Everything's clean and prepped and put together. And then you could tap those bolsters and forge weld them on. You would at least need a hammer. Hopefully you have a hammer and like a vise that has the little flat anvil area. You don't have to be, you're not forging really hard. This would be very tiny, like light little taps, even with a ball peen hammer. But like not the ball peen side, you'd use the flat side. You could set that weld, and then grind an integral out of it. I think the trick would definitely be taking in consideration when you're hammering those surfaces, together, there's going to be some compression in that area on the original blade stock. So you actually want your blade stock to be just a little bit thicker, than what you want the finish piece to be. That way you can account for that compression that happens when those bolsters are forge welded to the steel. Now, if you're doing Damascus, you can do the same thing. But you don't want to do this with stainless, unfortunately. Stainless requires a whole lot of other stuff to be going right for stainless to weld together properly. But if you have carbon steel Damascus, you could probably get it to forge weld to the make bolsters for your material, or for your blade. But if we go back to it being a monosteel in regards to it starting as round bar or hex bar, there's also large stock square bar or rectangular bar. And honestly, I have the round bar and I have hex bar from our friend Lawrence Lake over at Maritime Knife Supply, where you can get your, I think it's 1084, 1085 high carbon steel hex bar in multiple sizes. Lawrence is a great guy and he's part of the knife making community. He's not just selling stuff. And you can get all your other knife making materials that you need from him. He doesn't do any codes or anything, but he does. If you buy 10 belts, he'll throw an extra one in for free. But he keeps those prices really low to help all of us to fight, you know, all that extra cost of everything. So he's just keeping those prices low. But you can get the hex stock from him. And I'd have to double check. I don't know if he sells round bar, but I know he has the hex stock. And I've forged blades from that hex stock. Now, because I'm forging chef's knives, which are typically quite tall at the heel, they're either 2 inches, which is roughly 50 millimeters, or a little bit more, possibly even like 52, 53 millimeter, which is about 2 1/4 or 2 1/8. So I want my stock to be wide already. So even if I have like 1 1/4 hex bar, I will take that and I will forge it down. If now we're talking in a situation where you have a forge, you have a press or a hammer, you have the ability to move material, especially big thick material like that, easily, then I would take, like, for a chef's knife, if it's the 1 1/4, I would take like 2.5 inches and I would forge it down to probably about 1.5 inches tall, and then I'd flatten it out into a rectangular stock, because for me, I want some of that heel height there already as I start to then upset the material and forge down for what will become my integral bolster in the hidden tang, and then I can start drawing out the blade and isolating the bolster from the blade and blah blah blah. It's hard to really kind of describe what's going on unless you've actually seen it or see it being done in person. But whether it's round stock, whether it's square stock, whether it's hex bar, it could be whatever, I always reforge it into my ideal starting shape, which is a rectangular bar. That is usually, it's about 1.5, 1 1/4 at the narrowest. Again, because I want some of that height already, so that when I go to pull down the heel from my 2 2 1/4 inch or 2 1/8 inch wide blade, I have some of that height already, rather than trying to pull it down from 1 inch square stock, which would be a huge pain in the ass. That little 1/4 inch or 1/2 inch makes a huge difference. And then, so it's 1.5 inches, say, tall, 5/8 deep, 5/8 of an inch deep, and then maybe like 2.5, 3 inches long. And that's usually my starting block that I work from. And again, it doesn't matter what stock I get it from. I always reforge it to that shape, and then I start forging an integral.
Yep.
There's a lot of jargon and blah, blah, blah. But it really...
I completely agree with you.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
As you should. All right. This next one is from at NM. I don't know who that is, but it says stonewashing. Ooh, this might be a better one for Jeff. Or have you done any stonewashing?
Very, very basic stuff, but okay. Let's see if we can work it out.
Yeah,
let's,
sure.
Let's see. Yeah, yeah.
All right. Stonewashing. Before scales fully glued up and shaped, or after the shaping and grinding of the scales are all done. Or stonewash pre-glue up and then do it again at the end to get the exposed steel around the edge from grinding down handle. Appreciate you all from at NM. All right, so stonewashing before or after, it sounds like before or after handle work. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, particularly with scales, because I think what he's getting at is if you do the stonewashing beforehand, then fit your scales, then grind your scales back, you're going to have, the edges where it meets the steel, you're going to take away that stonewashing. Mm-hmm. I'd say don't stonewash. Get your handle ready. Make some sort of. I mean, if this is a full tang, so make some temporary bolts so you can bolt the handle on. Do all your shaping. Get your shape all, right in there as much as you can, a really nice fit up. Then take your bolts off. You can then go on to stonewashing your blade and doing all the finishing work to your blade. And then you can put your handles back on, just being a bit careful with your epoxy so you're not getting like massive squeeze out, that kind of thing.
Sure.
There's a couple of ways you can help with that. So on the on your scales, drill lots of sort of dimples into the side that's going to be hitting the steel so they can take up any slack with regards to your glue. You can fill up those little divots, I suppose. And just generally use a lot less glue than you think you'll probably need. And you should be good. It is a difficult one because, I've seen plenty of knives. They've got a lovely stonewash finish. But, when you look around the edges, you can see, that's been ground down a bit.
Sure.
But I think, if you make some sort of sacrificial, you can do it with Corby bolts,
sure,
by just using an angle grinder and putting some sort of screwdriver sort of slots in. So you can fit them up pretty much as they'd be a finished knife, but then you can just take them back out.
Yep.
Get that blade stone washed and then refit your scales at the very end.
I think that would be my move. Is, yeah, like you're saying, temporarily attach those scales, do all the sculpting you need to do and take them back off and then do the stone washing and put them back together. I do think one thing would be to make sure whatever the hole is in your tang where the Corby bolt is passing through, that is really dialed in so that when you do attach the scales back on, there isn't any weird play. Because if the hole is just even a little bit too large, much larger than that shank, the bolts are going to, or the scales are going to slide around and you might start getting a little bit of misalignment. So make sure those Corby bolt holes in the tang are really dialed in.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. Who needs Jeff, eh?
Yeah, fuck Jeff.
Who needs him? Fuck Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff, for everything you do, by the way. You're amazing.
He's stuffing his face with smoked fish, I'd imagine, at the moment.
Disgusting.
Yeah. Bayard Knives. Some question and feedback. Hey, gents, what's your everyday carry knife tool? Or are you often found without a knife? He says, thanks for always being authentic and sharing your knowledge and experience both in and out of the shop. And that's from Aaron at Bayard Knives. Okay. So an everyday carry knife, Mareko, what are you packing?
Well, I usually have handy whatever was given to me for free. And my father-in-law likes getting everybody little folding knives as stocking stuffers. And they're usually like cheap little things because they're stocking stuffers and there's like 20 people that he is to get stuff for. And so that's usually what I'm carrying. And it's just like a little Beater Spider Co. knife, honestly. And I think the blade is maybe only like 50 millimeters. It's just a tiny little thing, but mostly it's just for opening boxes and, or cutting tape, or scraping metal. So I don't usually have a very nice knife on me because I'm usually being kind of rough on it.
Yeah.
What about you?
I barely carry anything. European laws are slightly different to the US.
Sure.
And I'll use my keys if I need to. That's
gotcha. Or your teeth.
But no, I mean, if anything, I mean, we eat out a lot at sort of various sort of like picnic spots.
Sure.
Where you can just show up. So we generally, I've just got a bunch of Opinels and I'll just throw a few in a bag, you know?
You don't have the lug y'all?
No, definitely not actually. No.
You don't like them?
I'll tell you about the Lagioles in a second. Sure. But Opinels, they sell everywhere here. The supermarkets, they're at the counter. You go to the newsagents, they're at the counter.
Yeah.
They're everywhere, and they're sort of like €5 or €6.
Yeah, they're so affordable there. It's crazy.
They're great knives, you know? Yeah. They've got great blades on them. So we've got a bunch of them in all the different colors and all sorts of things. So, yeah, we generally just take them. And the girls use them now as well. So they do Opinels for kids with rounded edges, so no sharp point. So the girls have their own knives as well. So when we go out for picnics, they can use them. Mm-hmm. Lagioles, I mean, so Lagioles are, people outside of France think they're very fancy and they're very expensive. certainly in this area of France, they're not thought upon that way.
Sure.
And they're very cheap, actually. Again, they sell them in supermarkets. You can buy... The problem with Lagioles is the actual brand.
Yeah.
So Lagiole, which was that famous brand that made these expensive knives, and they had a particular shape about them. They'd have a little butterfly thing on the spine.
Mm-hmm.
They have been copied so much now that I think they've actually lost rights to the sort of copyright on it.
Oh, they didn't protect
it.
Oh, interesting.
They didn't protect it. So you can buy like a $2 Lagiole in my local supermarket. And it looks exactly as a Lagiole would look.
Yeah.
They aren't really thought upon as great knives, simply because there's so many cheap copies out there, mm-hmm. Which seem to be like almost like legit copies. You know, they sell them in real stores. They're not like, you know, on dodgy markets.
Right.
So people generally don't use them really.
You're not just popping into the petrol station and grabbing
exactly. Yeah. And they'll sell them on the counter in the petrol station. Yeah. Yeah. And they're branded as Lagioles and they look the same. They got all the same design features.
Yeah.
So I don't think they've sort of looked after, their sort of IP, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So it's awkward, but yeah, Opinels are everywhere here. They're cheap. I love them actually.
Yeah,
great.
I like them too.
I've got a really good collection of them as well. So they do like limited editions. They do like the blacked out versions. They do all these great things. So I've got a bunch of them because they're cheap.
You need to start modding. Just buy a bunch of them and just use your fiber laser and start modding them and then selling them.
There are. There's a huge market for that.
For sure.
For modded up in elves.
Yeah.
And if you look on YouTube, there's people who, you know, it's a massive thing for them.
Right.
There's a thing about that. I love them. Really do.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay. What's great about that, sorry, just because they're so inexpensive and you can make a few mods and then you can sell it for like 20 or 30 euro.
You know? At least. Oh, you're at least. Like, yes. Yeah.
5x it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a couple of like 100 euro op in sure. which are sort of, you know, they do, let's say, these limited runs and stuff. And yeah, they're just great. They do the job. And, you know, if you lose them, it's not the end of the world, let's face it, because you just pick up another one.
Mm-hmm.
You know? In the next shop you go into, basically. Yeah. Okay, we need to tell people about these guys.
Combat Abrasives makes the world's best abrasive belts for knife makers, available in any size at unbelievable prices. Go take a look at combatabrasives.com and get 15% off with promo code KNIFETALK15. Do it now!
15% off. That's a hell of a saving.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, head on over to combatabrasives.com and use Knife Talk 15.
You know what? I'm out of 220s right now too. The
really?
Flexible ones. I have like the heavier backed ones, but when you're doing the handle sculpting, especially and you have like tight little contours you're trying to get into and corners, I need that flexible belt and I just don't have them. So I gotta go get some. I swear to God, I ordered some, but apparently I didn't last time I got belts. So
right.
I need to get some really bad actually, because I have some handle sculpting coming up.
I can attest to their longevity as well. So we talked last week about me having a bunch of old belts, and I was a little bit scared to stick them on the grinder, and I was expecting them to come apart and slap me on the face because they're literally years old and they've been.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to KundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50. In order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to BADLANDS ranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Moved from our previous house into a garage, and they've got, you know, they haven't been stored well at all. But no, they're working absolutely fine. So I'm very sort of gingerly turning on the grinder and sort of stepping away a little bit as I turn up the VFD. Yeah. But no, they're absolutely fine. They're working
great. That's great. Yeah, makes a big difference. Okay.
Leonardo Lee. Do you want to take that one?
All right. This one is from Leonardo Lee. A question for you chaps. How thin can a layer of nickel steel be before it is no longer visible? For example, let's say I was making random pattern Damascus starting at with 1/8 thin, 1/8 of an inch thick stock. Every time you fold the billet, the layers have in thickness. So if you fold it 10 times, it would be about 1/8,000th of an inch, or 0.12,000ths, or 0.003 millimeters. At what point does it just blur together? What do you think, Craig?
I've never ever done it. So Mareko, this is all on you again, I'm afraid.
Okay. So I think there's some mistaken thinking about this, because it actually happens sooner than you think. So if the stock is only 1/8 of an inch, which is about, what is that, just about 3 mil, then if you're taking that original stack, say it's 4 inches tall, then you are reducing it down to 1/4 of an inch. Everything has gone through a massive reduction. Often when I'm restacking my material for, say, just like a straightforward random pattern, I'm taking it down to 1/4 of an inch. So I'm getting everything stacked up and cut into as many pieces as possible in the next stack. And that 1/8 of an inch becomes that 1/8 of an inch becomes 0.008 inches. Very, very thin. So just about 2 or 3 times the thickness of a human hair in just that first round of welding. I think the trick is, though, like, the layer count doesn't necessarily reflect how it presents in the final piece, because that comes down to how disrupted was the pattern as you were forging out the blade, or did you ladder the pattern, or did you do some sort of material or layer manipulations to kind of help reveal the different layers. And honestly, if you kept everything like, you could take it up to 1,000 layers, but if you keep everything really, like, you roll it, put it through a rolling mill, and everything just stays really parallel the whole way through, you're basically not going to lose any activity at all. You'll be able to see all those lines quite easily. And that 1,000 layers is, again, in only about 4 millimeters, or about 185 thousandths of an inch or so. Just under a quarter. 3/16. But that's 1,000 layers So that's going to be really fucking fine. It's amazing. You can still see those layers just fine, especially if they're laddered or you forge it out, pattern it or whatever. But once you get beyond 1,000, you're starting to get into a range where the pattern doesn't look very interesting unless you do very minimal pattern distortion. Honestly, I like to try to stay around 250 layers to about maybe 600 or 800 at the max, because once you get too high, one, there are potential issues in etching the pattern, but two, it just doesn't look very interesting, really. Everything kind of becomes homogenized in a way. And honestly, that's where in Japanese tradition, when they fold the steel over and over and over and over again. They're not doing that to make a pattern. The pattern is a happy byproduct. What they're doing is they're trying to homogenize the material because they're mixing steel that is really high carbon content and steel that is very low carbon content. And so by folding it multiple times, and they don't do it a ton of times, they do it maybe like 12 rounds or so, 12, 13 rounds of forging. So they're actually getting it all done in basically one day. But you're homogenizing the material. Now, there are always going to be some discrepancies. You will see a little bit of activity, but it's not interesting. It's not very interesting, especially once you get above 1,000, at least to me.
Yeah.
Patterns I see that are above 1,000, and I actually just did it recently, accidentally. I lost track of my layer count and how many pieces I was multiplying it by and blah, blah, blah. And I ended up taking the layer count up to like 12,000 or 10,000 layers. And I was fuck. I was annoyed because I'd spent all that time making the steel, but because I'd taken it so high, it doesn't look like anything. It looks fucking useless. I don't know. It's not very interesting to me. So anyways, I have that laying around the shop now. I don't know if I'll ever finish that out, but it is hopefully a lesson that I will take with me and carry on going forward, because I do not want to make that mistake or waste that time or that material again. And so, yeah.
So aesthetically, you don't see those distinct layers just because they're so compressed.
Yeah, exactly. And especially all that time at high temperatures and forge welding, the material actually starts to kind of trade elements, and it really does kind of become more of a homogeneous material. Now, I'm not saying that you won't see pattern. I'm just saying that the pattern that will be seen or presented in the final piece usually is not very interesting.
You know what you should do?
What's that?
Fuck it all up and head all over to damassteel.se.
Exactly.
And get yourself some of the finest Damascus style stainless steel out there. Damassteel.se. We've worked with them for some time now. Great people making a great, great product. And if you look on their website, you can see the patterns that they do. They make these on sort of a mass scale. So you can be guaranteed that, you know, the pattern that you pick will be sort of uniform across multiple bars as well. So that, you know, what they're doing is really, really great. Super easy to use as well. So if you've never worked with any sort of stainless or Damascus before, Damassteel is the one to try. They've got great sort of guides on the website too. Damassteel.se, and they're Damassteel AB on Instagram. Go take a look, because people are making some really sort of special stuff with it, because it finishes so great. So yeah, Damassteel.se and Damassteel AB on Instagram.
You saying fuck it all off made me think of this post I just saw recently where this guy was making burgers, and he was talking about how he doesn't usually like to grill because he feels like it's faffing around anyways. And I was like, faffing around? What does that mean?
Faffing. Yeah. It's a fuss. It's just like, you know, there's easier ways to do something. You're just faffing about.
Faffing about. Okay. I got you. All right. That makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. Where are we? That was
Leonardo.
Okay. I'll do Jordan Ford Tough. Jordan Ford Tough, I think it is, on Instagram. But fellas, question about doing full flat grinds. What is your approach when starting your grinding? What I've been doing is I mark my center line down the length of the knife. I break the corners at 45 degrees. Then I get pretty close to my center line, but then I start bringing the bevel up higher and higher. I'm currently doing this grinding freehand without any jigs, but what I found is sometimes I get too close to my center line too early and have to basically start a new bevel up higher and slowly widen that bevel until it's meeting up with the first bevel. Mm. I cut close to that cutting edge. So it seems to be a constant adjustment of cutting new bevels up higher or lower and eventually blended them together in a full flat grind. It always seems to come together for me at the end, but I wonder if there's something simple that I'm missing. I do have a jig that I have found it to be too cumbersome in changing sides back and forth. Jigless grinding is just more my style. Thanks, Jordan. Okay, so I mean, yeah, he's doing basically the way I do it. So yeah, what I generally do is use some sort of blue dye, some blue ink, and mark that down the center. Use a scribe down the center line. I mean, you get a feel when you're grinding for that center line anyway, but it's a nice visual to get your starter down with. Mm-hmm. And as he says, break the corners at 45 degrees. Yeah, that sort of makes sense. Then get pretty close to my center line, then I start bringing up the bevel. Yeah, he's doing basically the way I do it. He mentions jigs. I generally use jigs at the end. So what I used to do, I used to get quite mathematical about it and do, you know, okay, so if it's 2 mil stock and you can use Pythagoras and work out your exact angle and you set the jig to that angle.
Right.
But I mean, but that's in a perfect world where you're if you're using a jig, you're using a tool rest and that's perfectly set at 90 degrees. But you're using such sort of fine margins that, you know, at a hundredth of a degree difference makes a huge difference.
Sure.
So you'd always have to make these constant adjustments anyway.
Faffing around. So
you're faffing about, exactly. So I basically, Jordan, I personally use exactly the same method as you. Of center line 45s and, you know, breakaway out. And yet, you're right. Sometimes you don't get the angle right first time. And you're just playing about a bit until you sort of find that right angle. But what I generally do then is find that angle, turn the grinder off against the platen. I will put the knife, once I know I've got the angle, I will put the knife into a jig. And I use a jig where you can turn things over, you know, the other side very, very quickly. So I push the jig against the platen, so it's tight up against it, then tighten everything up. So I know I've got that angle that I finished with. And then just using the jig just to tidy things up at the end, just to make sure that's one big full flat as opposed to a bunch of small bevels, just to get it perfectly flat. You're doing the way I do it, basically. I think you've just hit the nail on the head. It's just hard. At the end of the day, what we do isn't easy.
Yeah, yeah.
But Mareka, what about yourself? Do you have a tried and tested method?
Are you singing Jigga Jig Out every time you do that now? Is that going to be in your head?
I'm not, but I should do. I should do.
Yeah.
And in fact, if anybody wants to put up videos on Instagram and they want to put Jigga Jig Out, so I get some, I wouldn't say revenue, but we certainly get some Spotify hits.
Yeah, awareness.
Feel free to do
awareness
that.
Awareness is gold. And it's especially if you're using jigs, fucking do it. Jigga Jig Out.
Exactly. If you use a jig and you're not using that song as a background, I'll be upset.
You're dead to Craig.
In fact, you're dead.
You're dead. I actually do... basically the same approach when I learned that when I worked for Bob, but instead of scribing the center line and going and working all the way to the center line from coarse to fine, we would actually back off of that to where we were working down to about, what was it, like 20 thousandths or so. So you would scribe, say it's a full thick blade, you figure out what center is, and then you back off one way or the other, either up or down, especially if you're using a height gauge, or even an edge scribe, whichever. Back it off about 10 thousandths or so, scribe, and now you have this 10 or 20 thousandths of an inch region, or basically about 1 mil down the edge. You have this region that is kind of a no man's land, at least when you start. But then you still cut in your 45s. You cut in 45 and then you flat grind, you get down to that. And then instead of getting down to it too early, you're working down to what is still a flat edge. And then at that point, once I've gone through like say the 36 and 60 grit, then at 120, that's when I will then, you can either scribe the edge again, or you can just, because 20 thousandths is already pretty thin, you can just basically sharpen the knife evenly both sides. That line should stay pretty well centered, unless you really struggle with that. Then I would try to jig it out and jig it out and scribe it. But otherwise, just sharpen the knife, and that way every time you're creating a new reveal. But you at this point you're working with finer grits, which are removing material just a little bit slower, and you can more gently and slowly work down to that center line or that center region. You probably don't want to go all the way to that center line, because if you flat grind all the way to the center line, you end up with a bit of a foil of sorts. So say you want it to be 10 thousandths at the edge before doing your final sharpening, or before moving on to hand sanding. Even you can even just scribe that out, keep that flat, that region. So instead of doing a center line, you have that center region that you're working down to. And then just do all the same shit you're already doing. But that way you're not getting all the way to the center line in your rough grinding or primary grinding, I guess. That gives you a margin of error to work with, so that then you can follow with your hand sanding, and then, which is still removing material, and then you can scribe the center line or just sharpen the knife at that point when you're done, and you should be able to rock and roll from there. But yeah, that keeping, preserving kind of like that flat area along the edge has really helped save me. And actually, I fucked this up actually not that long ago. I forgot about that step, and I was getting crazy with my grinding, and I took everything down to the center line too early, and I was still at like 120 grit or even maybe 60 grit. Hmm. And it was just too early. And I was like, fuck, I got to pull this edge back. I've done this lots of times. In fact, for a while I was factoring that in into my grindings or into my forging. So I had basically about an eighth of an inch to work with so I could pull the edge back every so often, because while I was trying not to, I always almost inevitably almost always did grind to that center line too early. Yeah. So I'd pull it
and
back.
That can actually help as well. Yeah. So, I mean, if you think when you're done, you put your blade down and you put it towards sunlight or, a light source behind. Sometimes if those, your flat edge isn't exactly fully flat, or you see some light coming through somewhere where you haven't been exactly even, sometimes just taking that edge back just a slight bit so you know it's perfectly straight, and then resharpening again from there can really help sort of fix those as well. Yeah.
And actually, I'm remembering now that part of the reason I would do that is because when I would do my finish grinding, I would basically hold onto the tang and out at the tip, and I just do wide swipes. And now I do really focused grinding, and my thumb is pushing on the material right behind that belt. So it's only grinding where my thumb is applying pressure. But out towards the tip, about an inch and a half from the tip or so, it would end up being a little thinner there than elsewhere. And so I would have to pull that edge back and reprofile, essentially, like you're saying, reprofile the blade because there's some weird inconsistencies in the blade. Yeah. And then I would sharpen from there. But I've tried over the years to really not have to do that, because one, it's just pain in the ass, but two, it's just about developing skill and figuring out little hacks like these that help to get you to that point so you can make knives much easier. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Do you want to take Fox River Blades?
Okay, Fox River says, hey guys, quick question. Do you know of a way to prevent surface conditioning belts from washing out crisp grind lines? They give a great finish, but the loose strings always mar the piece and wash out the bevel lines. Any insights would be appreciated. What do you think?
So I think what he's getting at, say you're doing something like a Scandi grind, and you want to, so you maybe used a surface conditioner or whatever you've used. So you've got your grinder lines running along the blade, but then when you put the, your bevels in, obviously, your machine lines are going the other way. I've certainly used surface conditioning belts to do that.
Sure.
And when I was doing my camp knives, because they had a Scandi grind, I wanted to keep that line, as you said, as crisp as possible with that bevel line. And using a surface conditioner, it does sort of dull that line, doesn't make it as crisp as possible. So what I was using is painter's tape, a couple of layers of painter's tape, and just follow that crisp line that you want. Mm-hmm. One thing that I could never get right was, the end of the, I'm trying to think of the words for the, the technical words for these places. But the end of the grind where you generally want sort of right angle going up into.
Oh, the plunge.
The plunge there, where you generally want that to be a really nice crisp right angle. What I was finding is that sort of rounds off, just that corner, that 90 degree just rounds off. And I couldn't really find a way to get over that. In the end, I just sort of went with it and made that part of the sort of design, I suppose.
Sure.
But if you want those sort of plunge lines to be perfectly along the blade, perfectly sharp, a couple of layers of painter's tape really works. And as soon as you start biting into that painter's tape, just stop. But when you do remove it, it works really well. So that worked for me because I was laser etching the whole blade.
Mm.
And they had these patterns on them, these like symmetrical patterns, all these kinds of things. Yeah. And then the grind of the bevel itself wouldn't have them. So I wanted that to be extra crisp, just to show you know, where the etchings were and where the thing was. Yeah. But yeah, painter's tape certainly worked. But yeah, Mareko, maybe you've got a solution for that corner as well, so that corner doesn't round out.
I don't really. I will say, because the Scotch-Brite belts or the surface conditioning belts, they have so much give and they're kind of spongy in a way. It is hard to keep things crispy around those areas. And I think as best you can, you can honestly, you don't have to be, you don't have to have the grinder flying. You can slow it down and some sort of structured abrasive or even, what is it? They make these belts, they're cork belts. They're still a little bit softer and kind of like a conditioning belt, but they don't have as much give. But they do have like an abrasive quality to them, and those could potentially help with keeping things nice and crispy without accidentally rounding off plunge lines or that transition from that flat surface of the blade down into the bevels and all that kind of stuff. It could help to really keep those things nice and crispy. My friend Zach Buchanan, he makes a lot of what is it called? Bob Loveless like replica style or Bob Loveless style knives. And and that is a prominent feature is that bevel only goes up, it doesn't go the whole width of the face. It only goes to a certain point. And sometimes he's even doing like dagger grinds. And so he has a sharp ridge that he's trying to maintain. And if he's using conditioning belts, that would probably very likely wash that out. But because he's using the Scotch or not Scotch Brite, but sorry, the cork belts, he's keeping things really nice and crispy while raising that scratch progression or that scratch, up to a finer and finer point to where he's taking them up to like a mirror finish. I think there's a lot of steps in between to get to that mirror finish, but the cork belts really help a lot with refining those scratches while keeping things nice and crisp. And he's on Instagram. I think it's just Zach Buchanan Knives. If you're having a hard time, just look up Zach Buchanan Loveless Knives. He also has a YouTube page, and he's a really nice guy. He's very talented, and he's worth a follow because he does offer some instruction or some information, but his work is just fucking awesome.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And again, because, you know, this whole podcast is based around the community, so if anybody does have an answer for that that can help Fox River out, yeah, send it in to us. Justin Stinson.
Wait, we're not going to read this guy. He's a jerk. Have you seen his handles lately? They're so fucking good.
No.
Really? Finish this motherfucker.
I thought we had beef then. No. I was like, oh, wow.
This motherfucker. Wow. I go and hang out with him. No, it has nothing to do with me. His work is so fucking good, especially, but the finishes he's getting on his handles, he's doing something special. I think if he wanted to, potentially he could teach a class around how he does his handles because they're fucking crazy. They're so nice. Anyway, no, I'm just giving a hard time. He's actually great. his Instagram is Running Man Forge. Everybody should go follow him. He's doing really good stuff.
Cool. Okay. Well, he says, this is from, hey guys, my handles are the best in the world, but I've got a question about some ways to prevent cracks with Honyaki and Hamon knives. I've made thousands now. Ooh! And for some reason, I'm having a high number of blades crack. Maybe it's the batch of 1095 that I'm using, but I'd like to explore all possible variables. He said, bonus info, the steel is from New Jersey Steel. It's water jet at 1095, 8 out of 10. Honyaki Santuku's crack on the edge.
Holy shit, that's a
1575, 1400, neutralize. 1475, quench. Parks 50, 16-inch thick edge, 3/32 spine, and the edge is chamfered, and at 320 grit. I just don't understand. Thanks in advance, guys.
Okay.
Mareko, this is on
this
you.
This is on me. Okay. I would say when you are doing so basically the Honyaki or Hamon is a Japanese term for differentially hardened blades. So their Hamons are much more active and interesting looking, which is why I think he's using those terms, Honyaki and Hamon. Although I've seen differentially hardened blades that are just, you know, like torch hardened. So somebody use a propane, oxypropane or oxyacetylene torch to heat up the edge and then quench the blade while the spine stays relatively cool, but still hot as fuck. So don't touch it. Anyways, So what happens, though, between those two materials, or between those two portions of the material, and how you create the Hamon effect, is that essentially one portion of the blade is under kind of a clay. It's like a protective insulation jacket, while the rest of it near the edge is exposed. And so it, when you heat it up for your final hardening and you quench the blade, the exposed part quenches, while the insulated portion does not cool fast enough to properly harden. And that's how you get this pattern in the blade, because what you're actually seeing are different grain structures present in the blade, and then you get some of these ashi, these wisps, and so it's like a mixture of some of the perlite and all this kind of stuff. But basically, you have martensite along the edge, you have fine perlite along the spine, or even potentially coarse perlite, depending on how thick the material is. But anyways, there is a lot of stress in the material at this point. And this is almost never Damascus. This is usually just monosteel. Like he said, 1095, what is it? 10, W2, W1 is also great for hormones, but you can get in most monosteels, especially like I said, if you do like a torch heat treatment, you can get kind of a differentially hardened blade, with steels like 5160, 5200, like almost all of them, because it's only going to transform in the portion of the blade that was heated up. But again, it is very stressful on the material. Now, in the deeper hardening steels, which means they don't need to be cooled as fast, it's less stressful, though it is still stressful, because basically you have a mixture of this crystalline organization within the same material, and they're kind of pulling against each other in a way, and amongst each other, in stressful ways that cause this cracking often. And so, especially for, I think, W2, I remember reading a while back that once you quench it, you want to get it below the martensite start so that the blade is hardened properly. But before the blade gets below 100 degrees Fahrenheit, you want to like get it into a tempering salts or into a kiln or whatever, because once you the chances of the blade cracking go up exponentially as it gets colder at room temperature, or ambient room temperature, which is, you know, like roughly whatever, 70 degrees, maybe 20, I think, Celsius or so. And so once you get below 100, a lot of bad things potentially can happen. So you want to get it into the tempering oven or salts or whatever you got as quickly as possible after it's been converted, after it's been fully quenched. And so that might be, and I've seen a lot of people do this, and for some reason, some steels, like sometimes it doesn't crack. There, you don't have the problem. And so people will, they'll do the Hamon, they'll quench the blade, and then they'll let it just kind of like sit around and nothing will happen. But sometimes there's just so much stress in the material. It pulls literally, like I've seen the hardened edge of a blade basically completely crack off and free from the softer material of the blade. It's pretty wild. And so, and again, I think a big part of that is because it's under a lot of stress. So as quickly as you can get those babies back into the kiln for a temper cycle, the better. Even just like, if you're not ready to do like the full temper or whatever, for whatever reason, if, even just to do a snap temper at 300 degrees or something like that, just to help take some of that stress off of the hardened material, especially, because that's the reason we temper blades anyways, is because, there's a lot of stress in that hardened blade. Even if you didn't, for steel like W2, even if you didn't do the Hamon, you didn't do the differential hardening, you would still, because it's under so much stress, you would still want to get it into a temper as quickly as possible, just because it's under a lot of stress. Now, most steels, it's not as much of an issue, but these shallower hardening steels like 1095, W1, W2, I think there are others, what is it, Spicy White, which is 26 something, something, I can't remember what the name of it is. Anyways, I think you want to get those into the temper as quickly as possible after hardening them. And that's the only thing I could account for, especially for that much of a kind of a quote unquote failure rate for them cracking 8 out of 10. That's pretty freaking dramatic. And the only thing I can imagine is that he's working in batches, and then these blades are sitting around, untempered, and it's a lot of stress, and then shit's cracking, and it's a bummer, a big bummer.
Yeah. So 8 out of 10. Yeah. Jeez.
That's pretty brutal.
Yeah. Big bummer. Okay. Okay. Magic knives. Hey guys, I've
Magic kick.
Match kick. Sorry. Is it? But is that like the way the sort of Polish say magic?
I think. I don't know.
Possibly. Polish. It may be magic kick. Okay. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, hey guys, I've got a question. If I were to buy a new grinder, what would it be, Mareko?
I would suggest you go get yourself a Broadbeck. They're super flexible machines because not only do they accept tool arms from other platforms, but their tool arms fit in other platform machines. So, but they're great guys. Vince and Ryan are awesome guys, and their crew are all really great. And I love seeing them and spending time with them. They're doing everything they can to make really great tools for the knife making community. They're also honestly really great for woodworking and other general metal fabrication work as well. But they have such a wide array of tools that it makes their grinder kind of the Swiss Army knife of grinders. They have, I think there's like 6 or 8 different tool arms for their machines. So it really can be a multi-tool, I guess, of sorts in the shop, especially if you're working with very limited space. It helps to have a bunch of different tool arms that are capable of doing the same thing. Or sorry, different things, which is the opposite. So anyways, I'm going to stop rambling because I'm just fucking struggling right now. But anyways, you got to go support these guys. They're here trying to support you as well. Again, great dudes. If you go to broadbackironworks.com, get their full packages if you need them. The more you get at once, better deal. But they also have a bunch of great tool arms that are really handy for the work you're doing, especially the Mareko platen that I designed with them for that extra clearance right behind the hard platen. So you could take that hard platen out and have tons of space to work with for sculpting your handles. So again, go check them out, broadbackironworks.com. Use Knife Talk 10 at checkout and you will save 10%.
Nice. Okay. So Magic Asti has another question.
Okay.
He says, as a young knife maker, I every now and then wonder about the long-term impacts of what we do on our bodies. Personally, my family has a history in really bad arthritis that is often made worse by working hard with your hands. So I guess I was wondering, is this something you guys think about too? And are there any things you do to mitigate injury or long-term impacts of the job that are outside of the obvious? Just trying not to die of black lung or poisoning at the age of 30. Thanks, guys. Keep up the great work. Yeah, I mean, we talked about this last week. There's... You know, I mean, it's one thing using a hammer all day, swinging a hammer, and that sort of muscular damage that you could do there. But the other thing is just literally being in the shop. It can be dangerous enough. Mm-hmm. As you know, standing at a grinder all day with, you know, all these sort of dust and toxins everywhere. I'd say just make sure you're wearing a mask as much as possible. I found that really difficult, particularly in heat. I find wearing a mask in heat really bad. So I invested in one of the positive air pressure masks. So it's like a full mask, almost like a welding helmet. And it blows a layer of air over your face as well at the same time. So that does two things. It stops anything getting in, but also keeps you cool
as well.
Keeps
the cheeks cool.
Keeps those cheeks cool. So I'd say, yeah, they are a bit more expensive than just using a sort of regular sort of 3M mask with a bit of elastic around it. But if it's something that you're using every day, I'd say it's worth making that investment to be comfortable. Because if you're comfortable wearing your mask, you're more likely to wear it, you know, for those little jobs where you just think, oh, I'll be fine, it's a little job, I'll be fine. Right. But, you know, I was hugely guilty of that. And before you know it, you're half hour, 45 minutes in, find yourself still with no mask on. But yeah, so yeah, maybe just invest in something that's going to be comfortable for you. But yeah, keep that mask on as much as possible. We talked about the heights of our sort of tools last week as well. I'm sure Mareko will tell us all about, you know, the heights of anvils and that kind of thing now. But with regards to grinders, everybody's aware of sitting at a desk and using a computer, you know, the angles that your elbows should be, that kind of thing. But, you know, some of us are at a grinder for 5 or 6 hours a day. So make sure that's comfortable for you as well. you know, put as little strain on your body as possible. So just, you know, give things a little bit of thought, I suppose. Mm. A layout of the shop, so you're not having to, you know, trundle, you know, 10 meters back and forth, just to, you know, multiple times a day for simple things. Have what you need at hand.
You got to get your steps in, though.
I mean, you got to get your steps in.
That's
too,
why you got those Reeboks, right?
Yeah. But, you know, yeah, just, yeah, a little bit of thought. And it, to me, it comes down to comfort. If you can make things comfortable, you'll do it. It's easier to do. And, you know, Jeff would probably balk at that because he likes the struggle. But I like the comfort. But Mareko, with regards to sort of forging then, I mean, that's a completely different discipline. But, you know, hard on the body. Yeah. What tips have you got?
Especially when it comes to a lot of people have different ways that they like to decide how tall your anvil needs to be. I personally, for me, it's all about my material managing hand, which is my tong hand, my left hand, and where those tongs are at. And I like my tongs to be basically at waistline height, because some of the ways that I hold my tong is actually I'm pushing against one rein with like the heel of my hand, and I'm actually shoving it into my hip. So instead of relying on my grip strength, especially if it's a larger piece of material, I'm using my whole arm to and then my trunk essentially to help hold that material while I'm doing a really hard hit. And so when I'm holding the material in that way, I want that to be level with the surface of the anvil.
Use that trunk.
Yeah, use your trunk. And so that is kind of my guide for how I decide I'm working at the or what height I want my anvil to be. A lot of people say, you know, stand straight up and then hang your hand down, and where your knuckles are, that's where the anvil should be. I don't know if that's exactly true. I don't think that relates to my to how my anvil height is. I've adjusted it, yeah, so that essentially in most operation, my tong hand and the way that I'm holding my tongs is level with the ground. And so I've just adjusted the height based off of that. But outside of that, PPE is obviously crucial, like you were saying. Boots, clothes, respiratory health, eye protection. Honestly, respiratory health has actually been one thing that I've really neglected. And I've been in this game for like 14 years now, and I have a respirator, but a positive pressure, because I keep a beard. I should have a positive pressure mask so that so that particles aren't drifting into my mask like they are now. Positive pressure is just always blowing things out, and so it's never going to get in there. And I just haven't brought myself to invest in one of these systems. And I know even the one that Craig had, I think he has you have the JSP power cap or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, yeah. They're not massively expensive.
No, they're not. I mean, especially they're made in the UK or over in Europe. So I don't know if you UK people like to be called Europe, but anyways, they're made over on that side of the pond. And so they're actually...
Geographically, UK's in Europe. There's no getting away from it. Yeah.
They're substantially cheaper over there. So if you happen to be traveling over there, maybe that's the time to buy one. Actually, shit, I should have done that while I was over there. Anyways, I didn't think about it.
Give Jeff a call. He'll get you
oh,
one.
Oh, he did ask what he could bring back.
Big shiny helmet.
Yeah, the box is massive. It would be ridiculous.
Yeah, they
it's
are.
Like
yeah.
a check bag all by itself. Anyways, but one of those, or even I think 3M, and there are other companies that have positive pressure masks. I've actually used, what is it? When I was at Fingal's, Fingal has the 3M one that is like the helmet and the hose and the vest and all that stuff. I used to think that would be such a huge pain in the ass, but it literally takes like. maybe 15-20 seconds to put on or take off, and then once it's on and you're using it, you don't really notice it's there. It never really got in the way of anything. I like full on made a knife while I was at Fingal shop, and it was totally fine. So
And what's great about them as well, that it's a full face mask, right? As well. So I'm sure they're not rated, you know, for, you know, using a lathe and a tool coming back into your face, you know, but it certainly will help you know, if someone were to spring me, you know, a slap with a belt, for example, you'd be more than covered. I love them. And yeah, I mean, the one you just mentioned, like Fingal has, so basically all the power and the back
Versaflow, is all strapped to your belt.
I think they are. Yeah, yeah. The one I've got is the power cap, where the actual motor and stuff is actually on top of your head. So there's a bit of weight there, but thankfully the newer ones have the battery at the back of your head now. So if you think of just like a baseball cap, and on the back strap is where the little battery, the little rechargeable battery sits. So yeah, it doesn't feel particularly top heavy. You know, you get used to them pretty quickly. I fully endorse those things. They're great.
Well, and then so outside of PPE, I think something I've started doing lately, I think honestly just regular exercise, even if it's going for a walk, at least like 30 minutes. I think they say like 30 minutes a day, ideally, but even a couple times a week is massive. That'll make a big difference in how stiff your body feels, because we as human animals, as we are physiologically designed to move. And so any of this work we do, whether it's sitting at a desk or standing at a grinder or whatever you're doing, it's terrible for our bodies. They lock up, and like, it's the whole, if you don't use it, you lose it kind of situation. And that's exactly what will happen. And so figuring out ways to get movement back into your body. I actually do a very simple stretching and range of motion regime in the morning, and it takes about 3.5 minutes. It feels really silly, but holy shit, like throughout the day, my body feels so much better when I do that. Even if I do I have like a yoga progression that I go through. And again, that itself only takes maybe 5 or 10 minutes, depending on how many times I want to go through it or not. And my body feels so much better. My back, especially my back, my neck, my hips, my shoulders, all of those feel way better. Just taking that small bit of time at the beginning of the day. And you can do this in the shop. You can do it in the house before you leave. I don't think proximity to how close you're getting to start actually working really matters. It's just the fact that you're doing it again, just like walking a couple times a week will make a big difference. Doing this once a day, will make a massive difference in how your body feels, not just every day, but just like throughout the rest of your life. It's going to make such a big difference. Staying properly hydrated, keeping your joints, properly lubricated, essentially. Omega-3 fatty acids are also really helpful, for helping to keep your joints lubricated and everything kind of moving properly. I understand crayfish oil is a really good resource for that. Just be aware that if you start taking supplements and you're not just getting it from your diet, you're going to have fishy burps and it's going to taste like you just ate like smoked salmon or something like that. What is it? Oh, collagen. Actually, collagen is something I've started throwing into my regime. I actually need to go get some more from Costco, but collagen tastes fucking disgusting, but if you mix it into your coffee or if you have a morning smoothie or whatever, that will help to make it easier to take. But that will also help with the collagen throughout your whole body to help rebuild it, as well as helping to keep those joints lubricated properly. But yeah, just it honestly doesn't take a lot. Don't eat a bunch of shit. Exercise every once in a while or stretch every once in a while. If it is going to be a long day of grinding, pause, just take like set a timer for every like 30 or 40 minutes and just take literally 1 minute to put your body in an opposite position. So when we're standing at the grinder, we're kind of hunched over like Igor, looking straight down, right? So do the opposite. Mm-hmm. Roll your arms back, stretch your arms out, look straight up, arch your back into like a reverse C kind of shape. Do the complete opposite and just hold that for a few seconds and do that for a few reps. And that will make a huge difference rather than just standing hunched over at the grinder, at the drill press, at the bench, at whatever all fucking day long. Our bodies are designed to move. So put some movement back into your body and that will help make a huge difference in how well you're going to be able to do this work for a long time. And that's where I'm at. I'm looking, this isn't just a hobby for me. This is my career choice. I'm going to continue doing this for as long as I physically can and capable of. And to be able to do that, I have to take care of my body. And I also have an eight-year-old. And so it not only benefits me in my career, but also benefits me in the ability to run around and play catch with the kid or go on hikes with the kid and stuff like that. And if I don't take the time to do that, it's going to make that even harder. So yeah. Makes a big difference.
Yeah. Cool. I think with that, we caught it.
I think we did it.
Do you think we managed without him? I mean,
barely.
He's surplus to requirements, let's face it, these days. You know, if he's not swanning around the world doing whatever he's doing.
Gallivanting.
I'm starting to think now, seriously, whether, you know, we just cut him out. You know? It'd be a lot easier. It'd be so much easier. Anyway, we'll talk about this later. Thank you all for listening, and we should speak to you next week. Bye for now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.